You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com.
Well, I like to spend money. I mean, I do, you know. But I got to have money to spend money, right? Unless you're the federal government. They have spent $1.9 trillion from the Treasury to the states just recently. It's lining up for another $3 trillion maybe handout for infrastructure. Okay, I know there's probably reasons behind that. Some are justifiable. Others are probably debatable. But what happens to inflation when the federal government spends nearly $5 trillion it doesn't have in a matter of a few months? And this does not even go back to December when we spent almost $1 trillion ahead of this. I'll tell you, we're going to talk about that today with economist Dr. Robert Tino Sonora, Associate Director of the Bureau of Business and Economic Research, joining us to discuss. It's A, the stimulus, B, inflation, C, the deficit, and D, the debt. Today on Voices.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio. From Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now, he's in control. It's Tom Schultz.
That is so not true. Welcome, everyone. I appreciate you being here. It is 2 decades strong working on 3 Voices of Montana. It's Josh Shedd from Montana for Montana. Thank you for being here. Appreciate that. A part of your Montana mornings is pretty dang awesome. 22 years, 2 decades strong, working on 3. I hope you're having a good morning so far. I'm not going to try to spoil that. But, you know, we start talking about the debt and the deficit and stimulus packages and inflation. And, man, it might not be all that fun, but we got to talk about this. I think it's very important. Now, I've said here, I defended a lot of the spending because we've had the largest GDP in the world by far. Okay, China is really not that much of a close second. And then Japan and Germany, however you want to order that, they're not really even a close third and fourth. So in protecting that large economy in the wake of this economic shutdown because of the pandemic, some measures were necessary. Now, have we gone overboard? I don't know. How will we know? I know what. Let's ask Tino. Dr. Robert Tino Sonora, Associate Director of the BBER and Director of Healthcare Research, joins us as he has many times here to help us understand this. Tino, how's it going today?
All right, Tom. How are you doing? Can you guys?
Yeah, good. You're on. We're hanging in. I'm hanging in there anyway.
Awesome.
I'd like to be rocking it, but I have some worries about the deficit and inflation and the debt, and thank you again for being here. I know you don't have all the answers, but as one of Montana's leading economists, it's going to be important to sort out some of these things. Let's start, just like as I put it out there, the stimulus packages. All right, we had one in December, $900 trillion. We had one back in May, I think, of last year. It was, what, $2.7 trillion. Another one just came out, $1.9 trillion. I think we lose sight of what $1 trillion is, and I'll have some figures out there, but how have we measured accurately, or when will we be able to measure accurately the effect of our deficit spending or our stimulus input into this economy?
Yeah, I mean, this is a real hard question to answer from an economist because, you know, usually when you have a scientific sort of experiment, you know, you have a control group and then another group that actually gets the medicine, you know. But here we just don't have that trial. So there's no, you know, thousands of alternative United States or world economies floating around that we can test a variety of different things. We can do simulations to try to figure out what's going on. But suffice to say, there's no real way in real time to measure it. I can sort of talk a little bit, however, about what happened during the financial crisis last decade, 10 years ago. When the United States actually probably underspent, most economists believe that the United States, the stimulus package back then was a little bit too small to try and pull itself out of that recession more quickly. But we did something, and the Europeans are sort of the sort of canonical case of what not to do. And they actually followed a very different strategy to try and pull themselves out of that recession. And they did a lot of what economists refer to as austerity policy, which means you basically do the opposite of what is needed. For a variety of reasons, of which we don't have to get all wonky in detail about. If you want to, we can. But suffice to say, what they did was, while the United States spent money and reduced taxes, the Europeans actually raised taxes and reduced spending. And what that did was precipitated a number of continuing euro crises, which happened for about 10 years. And they finally kind of put the euro crisis in the rearview mirror just a couple years ago. And now, you know, you get hit by this. And again, I think they've made some mistakes in their reaction again. Maybe not the same types of mistakes, but similar mistakes. And so when you look at sort of a test case of what not to do, or if you want to have a control group, the European Union might be that sort of test case to look at, where they kind of stumbled along for quite a number of years. Unemployment stayed very high. They went through a number of different recessions, whereas the United States, even though it wasn't as a rapid pull out of the recession, at least it was a sort of steady trot, if you will, coming out. And we didn't have the double dip that we were worried about a number of years ago, that W-shaped recession. Instead, we had a kind of a checkmark recession, or a Nike swoop, what people like to call it, too. But we did manage to pull ourselves out.
I think that I appreciate that an awful lot, because, I mean, that helps. And obviously, that has given us confidence as we have approached this pandemic and trying to pull out of it in terms of the philosophy going forward in that. I think part of, and please be wonky, because I think it'll help us all understand, and I believe our audience is up for this, the targeted stimulus. I guess I felt that first package was fairly dialed in. I'm not sure this latest package is all that dialed in on what is needed to recover.
Actually,
maybe it is.
Yeah, Tom. Yeah, I mean, actually, this package is pretty targeted, and it's not all going to be rushing out the door in one fell swoop. A lot of it's targeted at lower-income families, which are basically living hand-to-mouth right now. I know you're concerned about inflation. I'm somewhat less so, because, you know, it's not all coming out at once. There's a lot of money that's on reserve that's just sitting in bank vaults, and that's earning interest, and that kind of creates a disincentive for banks to flood the markets with money. Certainly during the Great Recession, again, the Fed increased excess reserves from, I'm kind of ballparking this, but excess reserves went from something like $2.5 billion just sitting in bulk bank vaults to roughly $2 trillion in bank vaults, and we didn't see any inflation coming out of that. And the Fed was able to sort of unwind that. I think the Fed has gotten fairly sophisticated at doing this and just looking at what the Fed's projections are in their last board meeting, the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the organization which basically sets interest rates policy. I mean, they're honed in on inflation. I mean, that's something they're very concerned about. And between most central banks in the United States, central banks in the world, most central banks are very, very keen on keeping inflation in check because of the distortionary effects that high rates of inflation can have. And so just looking at their charts that they put out for every Fed meeting, most governors, from the most conservative to the most liberal, presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks, they don't see inflation for the next foreseeable future above 2.5%. So I think what that does is kind of suggest that they're fairly confident that they can unwind this without having too much inflationary pressures. There is some concern that a lot of money is going in people's pockets, and that's going to generate some inflation. But again, it depends on what they do with that money. If they're going back and paying their landlords off for rent in arrears, or paying down utility bills if they're in arrears, or any other bills, you know, a lot of this money is going into food stamps. A lot of this money is going into helping schools reopen safely. A lot of this money is going – it's a huge list, right? I mean, I have to keep this in front of me.
So I know.
I just kind of keep track of it all.
Yep.
It's huge. But a lot of it is, helping kids, child care centers reopen, these kinds of things. And remember, too, a lot of inflation is going to be generated by – could be potentially generated by very low rates of unemployment. And even though the unemployment rate is coming down as it is, a lot of that's due to the fact that a lot of people have left the labor force, in particular women – who are now taking over a lot more childcare duties. And so a lot of women have left the workforce. And so when the economy kind of restarts again, we're just going to be pulling those people back in, which is going to help keep wages a little bit from spiraling out of control, which again is a pretty large inflationary pressure. And I think if anything's an inflationary concern over over the near term, it could be some of these supply chain issues that are happening. And we've just seen with this boat being launched in the Suez Canal. We had $10 billion a day in trade being tied up by the Suez Canal, forcing oil prices up in Europe because that's the main conduit for oil getting into Europe from the Middle East, or one of them. And so what you saw was immediate rise in oil, and that's kind of going to start building some of those inflationary pressures, I think. And that's going to come from the cost side or the supply side, less so potentially from the demand side.
Well, thank you, Tina. Dr. Robert Tino Sonora, Associate Director of the BBER, that's the Bureau of Business and Economic Research, and Director of Healthcare Research at the BBER. Okay, a couple of things on that. I'm sticking with stimulus here, but inflation is it certainly rolls right into that discussion. The last I read, there was still like $1 trillion not spent from the packages that the government had approved prior to, this new year, prior to the $1.9 trillion. And then we've got to talk about this infrastructure stimulus, because if you talk about supply chain issues, if we're going to flood our system with money, I think you're going to see inflation rise because people are going to have to pay more to get the work done. But I guess the question is, what's the need for a new stimulus package when there was still $1 trillion unspent from the last stimulus package?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, so I can't speak to that. What I can speak to is that a lot of the current stimulus package is going to be stretched out over 1 or 2 years even. A lot of it is in the form of tax credits, particularly for families with children. As I said, food stamps and these kinds of things. And so it really depends on what's being spent. And I think I'll tell you what I'm a little bit more concerned about than overall inflation. And this is you said I could get wonky, so I'm going to get wonky.
Yeah.
It's actually really what the bigger concern for me is how the fleet, and this is going to sound a little bit crazy, but how the inflation is actually calculated. Because what happened when COVID hit is, the way CPI and the rate of inflation is calculated is using the consumer price index, or the price of consumer expenditures, which is basically a fixed basket of goods. And what happened during the COVID crisis was actually, and which is happening still, is that people actually switched their spending behavior away from sort of the standard basket of goods towards a different basket of goods. Mm. And so what we see is actually in that sort of new basket is a little bit more inflation than in the sort of standard traditional basket, if you will. So, for example, maybe people spent more money on going out to restaurants and stuff, and less of their income was spent on restaurants. Well, that switched, right? Going to restaurants and less was on food at home, because they're going out to restaurants, say, 2 times a week, just hypothetically. But suddenly when the COVID hit, people were spending more on food at home, and those prices started to rise, and housing and prices on restaurants started to fall. People spent less of their income on restaurants. And so what you get is sort of this alternative CPI, if you will. One economist at Harvard Business School actually did a COVID CPI and found that the inflation rates for the COVID CPI were actually about 0.5% higher than the sort of standard CPI. You also have to be concerned about a lot of the inflation that's been going on in the past. First and foremost, inflation has been abnormally low, and a lot of central banks are worried about low rates of inflation. But we also have to understand that I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So suffice to say that we do have these concerns, and there are these different inflation rates. Oh, I know what I was going to say. And a lot of inflation that we have to think about, too, that's been happening over the past decade or so has been in housing and in healthcare. A lot of the day-to-day things, prices have actually been either falling or staying relatively low. So it's these other types of things, these housing and healthcare things, that are helping drive up some of this inflation, and less the sort of day-to-day expenditures, which are, in terms of your overall expenditure.
Lots to follow up on here. I got to interrupt you. We'll be back with Tino Sonora here in just a little bit. A friend of the show, he's been on a number of times to help us understand some things. Today we're trying to unpack the stimulus and the and inflation threats, and we'll get to the deficit and we'll get to the debt here. Dr. Robert Tino Sonora, Associate Director of the BBER. And Tino, again, appreciate your time here. Kind of want to back up a little bit. You talked about something that struck me. Abnormally low inflation. I think we can launch into inflation here now and talk about there's a lot of folks who don't have the same kind of worry that perhaps we had years ago. The Fed seems to be maybe a little more dialed in on keeping inflation in check. The talk I hear is that as we've had that abnormally low, and maybe you could explain what why it's abnormally low, 1.7% or under 2%, they're saying, you know, we want to get a five-year average of around 2%. So they're going to be willing to go up and allow 2.7% inflation before they start, you know, removing the punch bowl, as they say.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's kind of so the Fed, and again, when I say the Fed, I also mean most central banks follow the same basic tactic. They really want us. They have what is known as an inflation target of 2% and PCE, and that's the price of consumer expenditures. It's a little bit different than what most people are familiar with, which is the consumer price index or the CPI. It's calculated a little bit differently. But what they'd like to see is actually a 2% rate of inflation PCE, and actually they really would prefer that in the core PCE, which is removing food and energy prices from that because those are very volatile. And so the core kind of just represents things that don't move around quite a bit. So this will be like your cars and your washing machines, and there's not a lot of volatility in those prices. So that's what they're really targeting, is that 2%. And the reason that they don't want to see really, really low inflation is that creates a disincentive for firms to actually produce more goods. If you sort of think about the price, if you're sort of figuring out what to invest in the future, if you see prices basically stagnating or falling, there's very little incentive to produce in the future, and then that creates what we call a deflationary spiral, which is actually very, very dangerous and can be very, very hard to get out of. Again, you know, we don't have an alternative United States, but we have other countries that experience similar types of problems. Again, the main one would be Japan from the 1990s and 2000s, where they could not get any inflation in their economy, and basically they had about a 20-year recession, and they've spent billions and trillions of dollars trying to pull themselves out of that. So what the Fed does is they want a 2%, and what that does is basically kind of pegs, if you will, all wage contracts going down the road. It pegs interest rates down the road, and so it creates a stability in the economy, which allows people to forecast future events with a lot more clarity. And what the more clarity you have in the future, the better the economy tends to do, because people go, oh, you know, inflation is going to be 2%. Oh, that means I'm going to price in 2% increase in my wages, my prices, et cetera, and I can have a lot of long-term planning can be much more easily made with a lot more clarity. So uncertainty is the main concern surrounding inflation. And again, that 2%, and if the Fed is credible and people will believe that and say they will do those policies precisely to meet that policy target, and that's what people sort of count on, is that Fed credibility and the ability to meet that target and to do the policy that will achieve it.
We're going to see some competition for services, I think, as this money goes out of folks' wallets, hopefully spent wisely. And so I'm curious, because we have these issues with the supply chain, and so you know, are we always going to be under that line, so to speak, where we can't get the supplies we need, we can't get the work done that we want to get done, and so the competition then is artificially inflated because of that supply chain?
Well, I mean, everybody's going to be fighting for the same thing, and actually competition has helped keep prices fairly low at the consumer level, and firms are willing to absorb some of those costs to not lose market share, if you will. And in fact, you saw that with the recent Suez Canal problem, where the ship was basically, you know, blocked off world trade for a week or so, where a lot of the shipping companies said, look, we'll eat the cost of the increased cost of this crisis, because we do not want to lose market share and pass those higher prices on to our consumers. So the competition is actually helping keeping those costs low. Now, in terms of the supply chain issues, I mean, over the past, 30 years or so, the United States and most economies have switched to a just-in-time types of inventory, which relies heavily on global trade. So what's happening is that's kind of the $64 million question, is what's the new paradigm? Are American firms going to start moving more of their intermediate good production to the States or closer to home, say, instead of having it be in Japan or in China or Korea, they're going to move to Mexico or or Canada or to Oklahoma. I mean, these are kind of the issues. I think that's going to be one of those business challenges for the for the next few years, is just figuring out exactly what the new economy, quote unquote, is going to look like with respect to supply chain. And then, you know, we also have to think about what's happening globally. So if the European Union is going back into recession, that's going to reduce demand for some global inputs, some global outputs, and that will help keep inflation in check as well. We could also potentially see the dollar get stronger, which is going to make imports a little cheaper, which will also keep our inflation in check. So there's a whole bunch of variables out there that are really making this, I want to say, you know, overly complicated, but really kind of, you really have to look at it from a number of different angles. And so that's, but going back to your Fed question, and I think that's been helping the Fed actually kind of keep those rates at 2% or below, which it has been.
I got to take a break here, but we'll come on back. One thing I want to talk about as we focus on inflation, it's going to be deficit and debt a bit later on. I've got a text message here. I'll get that out when we get to it. And you're welcome to join us here at 781-627-5483. Line them up, because we're going to have deficit and debt discussion here in just a bit. But pension devastation, that's what people, as we talk about inflation, I think the worry about what's going to happen to their pension in all of this is very real, and something we need to talk about here with Dr. Robert Tino Sonora here of the BBER. Let's grab some headlines and be back with more here. Here's Brian Bennett.
The state is slated to receive $2.7 billion through the American Rescue Plan Act passed by Congress this month. And outside of infrastructure spending, all of the state's spending must be related to pandemic recovery. House Bill 632 would establish several commissions to provide guidance and rank proposed infrastructure projects. The House Energy Technology and Federal Relations Committee heard about House Bill 657 Monday. It would create a $200 million revolving loan fund to target broadband investment to underserved areas and create a state broadband manager to administer the fund and oversee the long-term development of Montana's broadband infrastructure. A constitutional referendum advanced through the House Monday, which would ask Montana voters whether to enshrine hunting, fishing, and trapping in the state constitution. Because it is a constitutional referendum, it needs a two-thirds majority of the entire legislature to pass. With Montana News headlines, I'm Brian Bennett.
Well, there's really no consensus on whether we're going to see inflation or not. Some economists are going to say there's too much stimulus. It's going to overheat the economy, going to be counterproductive. Others are saying that there's a lot of confidence in the Fed and their ability to handle unforeseen inflation. Robert Tino Sonora is with us here, Associate Director of the BBER. One thing that everybody is really concerned about is their pensions and whether they're going to be worth the same or worth as much, or what's going to happen here to our pensions as we see stimulus money possibly creating some inflationary pressures. Tino, that is something that folks worry about. How can we address that in an overall way?
That's a tricky question. Yeah. A lot of pensions are fixed price pensions or fixed pensions, so that makes it tricky. I will say that the recent plan has about $86 billion to help multi-employer pension funds to keep them solvent. I think there's a greater concern, particularly with some of the state funding and state tax revenues falling over the past year or two, that pension funds may potentially become insolvent. Certainly, inflation is going to eat into a fixed pension fund, and so we do want to keep that as a minimum, because obviously you don't want that to be eaten away by inflation. So, we just have to wait and see. But I did want to say that there is some money in the stimulus to keep at least some of those insolvent, which apparently will cover about 11 or 12 million workers in the United States. So there's that with respect to pensions.
Well, that's good. The inflation concerns, I'm not sure we can put those aside. We got about a minute and a half here. What would be indications that the Fed needs to dial it back a little bit?
There's the famous sort of dot plots that the FOMC puts out every other, I think, FOMC meeting, which is, again, the interest rate setting committee. And when they start seeing inflation rising, they will start predicting that reinflation. But the range on inflation forecasts for the next 2 years remain between about 1.8 and 2.5% per year rates of inflation, and that's what the Fed's seeing. Some of the other blue chip guys are seeing different inflation rates, and when we get done with the break, we can talk about what the markets are saying about inflation expectations as well.
Yeah. The markets have been strangely resilient, although maybe overconfident.
You know, it's hard to say. I think that the stimulus is actually going to help the markets, right? Because the stimulus is going to mean that the economy is still going to go, and people are actually going to, you know, get jobs, and profits are going to start to rise again. So, you know, for markets, in terms of stock markets, I think that's kind of a boost to the markets. And so when you see this increase, when they actually looked like they were going to pass the stimulus package, or the recovery package, I should call it, as more of a recovery, that the markets did respond positively. But the markets have been reacting kind of oddly in comparison to the overall macroeconomy.
Yeah.
And I suspect that has less to do with the macroeconomy and more to do with stock buybacks by firms.
All right, Tino, stand by. We've got a breakup coming here, and then we'll get to the $64,000 question. $28 trillion debt. How do we pay for it all? Back with more here from Montana for Montana.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening today.
The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 1-866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana, with Tom Schultz.
Appreciate you joining us here today. Really an in-depth discussion, stimulus, inflation, deficit, debt. Dr. Robert Tino Sonora is with us here, Associate Director of the BBER and Director of Healthcare Research. And if I haven't said it today, I say it frequently, the BBER is a great organization, and you should go to their website. They've got a ton of reports and information. They do the research, and they back it up. So I very much appreciate them and Tino being here. People love the graphs about how much $1 million is, or how does $1 trillion stack in terms of our relationship to the moon. And I get that, because I think, Tino, that we lose track of these numbers here. You know, we were talking millions and then trillions before we even knew it. $28 trillion. Now, if $1 million in $100 bills is about 40 inches, okay? If it's $1 billion, then it's 40,000 inches, and that's 0.63 miles high. Okay, $1 trillion then in $100 bills stacked up is 631 miles high, more than twice as high as the altitude of the space station, which is at 248 miles. And so let's look at our debt. $28 trillion using $100 bills, that would require a stack of cash 17,700 miles tall. Okay, distance to the moon is $240,000. So you're not even close, but you're 15% of the way there. With our average income in the United States around $50,000, paying off a debt that's $28 trillion seems just undoable. How does our debt get paid off, if it ever does?
Well, I mean, you know, the question is again, what is the debt going to be paid off? And again, what is that debt being used for? I sort of liken it to, one way to think about it is if you're going to get a grant or a loan for college, right? And if you versus getting that same loan or grant to buy pizza, if you invest in college, your income might be $10,000 a year. And then you might take on $50,000 or $60,000 in debt to do that. But at the end of the day, you know, you'll come out with a higher income, better situated to pay off that debt. And it's basically an investment. If you spend that same $50,000 on pizza, then you're just wasting money, right? And so it comes down to what you're actually buying with that money. Similarly with a house, right? How many people's mortgage are three or four times the size of their annual income? So that's a similar sort of thing. And you think about paying that off over 30 years. Now, obviously, the debt and your mortgage are different because you have a fixed amount of time to pay off that mortgage. But suffice to say, it's a similar sort of concept. You're investing in a home, which you are going to, A, live in, and then, B, will hopefully, at the end of the day, be able to sell it and make a rate of return on it. So it depends on what the debt is being spent on and what that deficit spending is being spent on. The United States national debt currently, as you said, is $28 trillion. The public debt, now there's different types of debt, right? There's publicly held debt, which is debt that's held by the public, and then also other debt that's held by either the Fed or by other government agencies. So the Department of Agriculture, say, might own some debt.
Mm-hmm.
So the public debt of the United States is actually about 100% of GDP, just over 100% of GDP, which is about, currently GDP is about, what, $20 trillion or so.
Yep.
Now, we in the United States are in a very unique situation whereby our debt is very desirable versus a place, say, like Greece. So we're able to finance projects. I mean, imagine if you could get a mortgage at less than 1% and fix it. You know, if you could get a 30-year fixed mortgage at a 0.5%, you'd be like, well, I could buy a lot of house for that. And that's going to put that debt, if you will, to income ratio pretty sizable. So that's kind of what we're doing, is we're almost borrowing with free money. And again, it depends on what we spend it on. We could sort of think in terms of financing some of these helping people out as an investment in the future. You know, is it better that we get them out of the hole today or worry about what happens in 5 or 10 years where we might have to incur even more debt to try to help them? So there's that part of the story. Another part of the story is, again, I'm going to use Japan, is there's an alternative universe. Again, as Japan's debt to GDP ratio, ours is about 102%. Japan's debt to GDP ratio is 270%, which is really high. And you got to ask yourself, now that's one of the strongest economies in the world, very low unemployment. As I said, they had a huge recession back in the 1990s, 2000s, and they really spent a lot of money trying to pull themselves out of that. And yet, they're basically borrowing at very, very low interest rates. There's a lot of faith in the Japanese economy. That's something that will not be, you know, awarded to a place like Greece, for example. But suffice to say, that economy is still going. My own research has shown, you know, a lot of people are concerned about debt to GDP ratios and the impact on economic growth in the long term. And we find actually relatively low evidence for that. There's no threshold of debt. The debt has to be below X percent of your GDP to actually be an impingement on debt. There was a famous paper about 10 years ago by some economists at the IMF and the University of Maryland, and they said that there's this 90% debt to GDP ratio that kind of is where things start to turn and your economy gets worse if you go over this ratio. That's been largely debunked.
But hold it. Doesn't this – and here's a text message. Isn't there a real problem with the government dishing out trillions of dollars? It really doesn't have – what is going to be the effect of us paying the money back? I wanted to get that out there as well. Chris, stand by. I got a question from you. But doesn't this defy basic economic principles? If our debt to GDP ratio, which if we add the state's debt according to the world debt clock, which I check once a week just so I could lose more hair, 145% our total debt to GDP ratio. Doesn't that just defy basic economic principles?
Well, it depends on what the economists refer to as your budget constraint. So you have a day-to-day budget constraint, and then you have a lifetime or, you know, infinite budget constraint. And if you can take that far enough into time, then it's not a binding constraint. And again, as I said, what economists would look at to reflect some of those uncertainties or risk associated with taking on more and more of that debt would be United States bond yields, right? And so the canonical one that most people look at would be the 10-year bond yield. And that's basically a measure, if you will, a barometer of what people's perception of the health of the economy is. And the lower that is, the better. And for the past, I don't know, I'm looking at the data right now, for the past, say, 10 or 15 years, that 10-year bond yield hovered in the 2.5% range, which is roughly the rate of inflation. So people are still want to hold American debt. When those bond yields start to spike precipitously, that's when we're going to start to worry that there is some some risk that we will not be able to pay off this debt. But right now, people, Globe is very confident in the United States being able to pay that off, and indeed is willing to take a lower interest rate on our debt compared to other countries' debt just for that security.
That makes me feel better. Let's see if it makes Chris feel better. Joining us from Kalispell, 1180 AM KOFI or 104.3 FM. Chris, thanks for the call. You're on with Tino Sonora.
Yeah, I don't know if this applies anymore. You know, when you're at the edge of the cliff, you know, two steps backwards is progress. I don't know if we can do that anymore. Hang on to your hair now. The national debt in 1991, when I was talking about this on the radio again, and encouraged people to read this book, The Government Racket, The Washington from A to Z Waste. And national debt back in 1991 was $3 trillion. So, I mean, you know, this is a progressive situation. I was listening to Larry Kudlow this morning, and he said that, tongue-in-cheek, that he was back when Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. And he said even socialists cringe when they run out of their own money. And he says he told Karl Marx that it wasn't going to work. It's just going to continuously get worse for all the people in the world, you know, especially the United States. So when your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep, your downfall, and I've been blurting this out for all these years. So if they went back and you would go back and listen to and read Martin Gross's book, Government Waste, he goes step by step by step. And if we applied some of those things and not listen to a lot of experts, but common sense, the way I run my business, the way I run my home, and all that stuff was when your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep, your downfall.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. And this is where I get it, too. I mean, maybe it can defy basic economic principles as we understand them, but also does it defy our moral sense, too? I mean, that's part of the context here. And what is the worst-case scenario? Is that parsed out there? A total crash of the world economy? China calls in. I know you said we've got intergovernmental debt and public debt, which is about 71%, I think, or thereabouts. They call in their markers. Is there a worst-case scenario that you've seen fleshed out anywhere?
Not for the United States economy. I mean, we certainly saw it in places like Greece, where people did call in their debt because Greece is a very sort of on the edge economy. The United States, much less so. The United States has a good place because it's the dollar is the global currency for the most part. So most people want to hold dollars. If China decides to dump its American debt, you know, they're just biting themselves in the foot. It's going to cause a whole host of problems, potentially throw the United States, the global economy into recession, which will impact their own economy. So, you know, the increasing interlinkedness, if you will, of globalization has basically meant that there is no incentive for any one country that's big. You know, obviously, if Greece does something, no one's really going to really bat an eye. But if somebody like a China does something, they'll notice, and it'll just turn around and bite them as well. And so we do have these kinds of issues, and I don't, you know, you do have to be careful that applying my, you know, so certainly the way I apply my the way I spend money is a lot different than the United States government can. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a finite lifetime. United States government right now does not.
I hope.
Right. That's the hope. Yeah. The big concern is, I mean, what would keep me up at night, and it's not keeping me up at night, but if it was, this is what it would be, is that people decide to dump American debt.
Yeah.
And that would cause a spike in interest rates, and that would be very problematic. But as I said earlier, there's no indication that at this point is happening. And in fact, when there is a crisis, people move into American debt rather than away from it.
As long as the dollar is strong. I've read that China has been trying to devalue the American dollar, that they're trying to suck up some gold. Wouldn't it be in their best interest to devalue? I know that they've got a lot of debt here, but what is the incentive for China to devalue or the opposite of that for the American dollar?
Well, I mean, you know, China doesn't devalue the dollar. China devalues or revalues the Chinese yuan, you know, obviously. So what they're doing is they buy and sell dollars to try and keep the yuan within a certain percentage, within a certain band, if you will. They got a more or less floating exchange rate now. It's basically what we call a managed floating exchange rate. I mean, they kept the yuan very undervalued, if you will, for quite a number of years, and that was an attempt to increase their exports. And then a number of years ago, I believe it was the second Bush administration, basically, you know, said no, that's not going to work anymore. You have to allow your yuan, your currency, to appreciate vis-a-vis the dollar, and it has. Again, you know, they don't want to do it. They don't want to bite themselves too, right? Because it's going to come back and bite them. And so they have to be careful about how they are keeping the value of the dollar. And my understanding is, too, is, you know, the Chinese want to also diversify away necessarily from the United States. So they might be holding more euros, for example, because they want to have more a greater degree of trade with the European Union, which is as collectively is the largest economy in the world. And so they're kind of looking to both shores. And also their local trading partners, right? So the Korea, Japan, Australia, those guys. So they got their eye on a number of different pieces. And so, you know, we have to kind of keep an eye on them in terms of sort of economic hegemony, if you will.
That's a good idea. And then we'll do that. I'm out of time here, Tino.
Okay.
I appreciate so much this conversation. I'll learn twice as much as I listen to it again. I'll put it up on the podcast and because I do learn an awful lot. I hope you're well. I hope you will be well. And I got to take a break and could you pop Tino up again just real quick? Tino, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yep. Say hello to everybody over there for us, okay? Wow, I'm not kidding. I do learn an awful lot as I go back and listen to these things again. We'll edit that podcast. We'll put it up there on our Facebook page, also on our website. It's voicesofmontana.com. Again, simple enough, voicesofmontana.com. If you want to also text me, you can do it here or send me an email. I'd appreciate that. It's tom@voicesofmontana.com. I've gotten some suggestions for shows. I'm trying to put those things together. I didn't get a chance to ask Tino about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. I'm looking into that. I'm looking into carbon credits. There's a lot of things that I think we can hopefully, you know, understand a little bit better as we move on from Montana for Montana. And look to northernbroadcasting.com. Log on. Click the Tow Rope Tour. I shouldn't say log on. Just click on and go to the Tow Rope Tour. We want your tow rope heroes, folks that have stayed connected with you, that maybe have helped you out of a jam during this pandemic or whatever in your life. Okay, we're going to honor them as we go out on our Tow Rope Tour. Tom Schultz, thanks. Have a great Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Voices of Montana. Comments and opinions heard are those of the host or callers and not necessarily those of this station, sponsors, or Northern News Network. Join us Monday through Friday at 9:06 for Voices of Montana.